Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And on the morning that Donald Trump was declared the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party, he said this about Ted Cruz's father.
His father was with Lee Harvey Oswald prior to Oswald's being, shot. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. What is this, right prior to his being shot? And nobody even brings it up. I mean, they don't even talk about that. That was reported, and nobody talks about it. But I think it's horrible.
That was yesterday morning, and then he won big in Indiana. And since this is a TV game show political season, Reince Priebus, GOP chairman, tell your rank and file exactly what they've won.
I don't think that's necessarily bad. I think something different and something new is probably good for our party.
Reince Priebus on CNN this morning, probably good for our party. His tone is interesting. Reluctant warrior, maybe. Not quite hostage video. But there's the Republican National Committee chairman on CNN this morning. And last night, he tweeted even more explicitly, quote, Donald Trump will be the presumptive GOP nominee. We all need to unite and focus on defeating Hillary Clinton, unquote. So what a change for the leader of the Republican establishment, which had considered a Trump nomination a scenario for the literal breakup of the party. Let's take stock. We'll get a few views. Our first guest is Glenn Thrush, chief political correspondent for Politico. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Brian.
So if Reince Priebus is now falling into line, like, here's a leash, please put it on me, maybe the Republican Party really now belongs to Donald J. Trump. Is that where we are?
Yeah. He has, inmates haven't only taken over the asylum. They've renovated it and started selling condos. This has been really in the wind for quite some time. I think it's pretty interesting. Trump has mastered the art of winning a primary contest. And let's just kind of put these numbers into perspective. Republicans and independents who vote Republican in Republican open primaries represent anywhere between 28 to 32% of the national population. Approximately 50, 54% of them went for Donald Trump.
Of the electorate, right? Not even of the population, but of the
electorate. I just want to, because I think there's this widespread perception that Donald Trump has taken over the country. He has not. He has essentially, it is the equivalent of the Mets winning in a weak Eastern division of the National League. Very weak competition, very, very easy, relatively speaking, to running in the general election to win in this particular climate, particularly when you're somebody who has such, raw political talent. Here's the problem. After 2012, when Mitt Romney lost a very significant landslide in the Electoral College to Barack Obama, the RNC, Reince Priebus and his crowd, who were associated, I guess Priebus was associated with Paul Ryan and Governor Walker of Wisconsin, but the group that did it were former really a cluster around Jeb Bush, Sally Broadwell, those folks. They put out a very important document that the now infamous postmortem that talked about the Republican community to reaching out to minorities, making a broader appeal to women, and generally moving towards younger voters. Donald Trump has won the primary, the easy part. Now it is Jeb Bush's revenge. The general election is being fought very much on those terms that the RNC outlined in 2012. In fact, the ball has moved significantly further down the field. We saw yesterday a report of Nevada, for instance, that Democratic registrations are outpacing Republican registrations, new registrations 2-1 in Nevada. Huh. There are 500,000 more potential Democratic voters in Florida. I think we are looking at a situation where Trump is facing a statistical reality that he hasn't even confronted yet.
A few months ago, there was talk that to save the GOP, there would be a third-party nominee to represent real Republicans if Trump wins the nomination. Is anyone talking like that anymore?
Yeah, there's still some murmurings on it. There are a couple of problems with that. John Sass, the freshman senator out of Nebraska, was the first one to talk about it. He tweeted yesterday that he is still in favor of that sort of thing. We had Steve Schmidt, the former McCain advisor, and also Mark Salter, another McCain advisor, talking about that yesterday as well. There are technical encumbrances to people doing that at this late an hour. But you got to think that someone's going to jump in and do it just because, you know, it's basically a dollar and a dream kind of thing. And that person would likely siphon away votes from Trump. The real issue here is down ballot Republicans. They are extraordinarily terrified about this prospect of a Trump nomination. You got eight senators who are Republican senators who are up for re-election this year who are sitting in states, Barack Obama, one in 2008, 2012, who are extraordinarily vulnerable. And you have some concern on the part of Paul Ryan and his cadre of leadership over there in the House that they're going to see their majority shrunk. So a third-party candidacy would give people like Mark Kirk, the extraordinarily endangered incumbent in Illinois, in blue Illinois, the Republican, an opportunity to, quote-unquote, support a real conservative without having to be for Trump.
What position does this leave Paul Ryan in particular in? He had that famous quote after Trump's Muslim entry ban proposal saying this is not what our party stands for, this is not what our country stands for. But he subsequently said, I think, that he would vote for Donald Trump if he's the nominee. So what do we make of Paul Ryan?
Let me use a Hanukkah metaphor. He is the keeper of the eternal flame. You know, as the battle rages outside, what Paul Ryan is hoping to do is to keep the core of the Republican Party as he believes it to exist, or what he believes the future of the Republican Party to be, burning, not very brightly, but enough that he is able to sort of sustain this vision for when times get better. Look,
but how does he do that? How does he do that while voting for Trump and announcing it?
It's going to be really difficult. I think, you know, the Wall Street Journal had an interesting take on the third party thing yesterday, saying people just kind of have to grin and bear it. But I think
Trump. Well, George Will, old line conservative columnist, said this week some version of maybe the party should just let Clinton be elected and regroup to defeat her in 2020. Otherwise, the Republican Party is destroyed.
And Bill Kristol is out today. Sort of, it's not clear what Bill Kristol, the famous neocon, is out there saying really similar things. The Republican Party, you know, Tim Miller, the former Jeb Bush communications director, Facebook, a post today saying the GOP 1854 to 2016. I mean, there's a lot of that kind of rolling around. But I think back to your question about Ryan. What Ryan is going to do is counter-program Trump. So you're going to see a second, you know, if you're going to talk about a third party candidate, not in actuality, but in terms of counter-programming, I think Paul Ryan is going to essentially be a shadow presidential candidate, shadowing his own presidential candidate, providing an alternative view of what the Republican Party could be in the future.
Is it on policy? Is it on trade? Is it on immigration? What is it?
I think it's going to be on all of those things. Mostly, though, Brian, it's going to be on tone. You know, I mean, if we learned anything from this particular cycle, is that tone is everything, both in a positive and negative way. Trump feels the temperature of his party better than anybody, or if it was his party until fairly recently. Right? He has a better sense viscerally of where they're at. Remember, what are the two most popular to the core Republican voters? What are the two most popular positions that he holds, even for people who didn't vote for him in the exit polls? The immigration stance, the wall, and 7 out of 10 in a lot of states, 7 out of 10 Republican voters support his temporary ban on Muslims. So he's got something that the core of his party wants.
Yep.
It's up to people like Ryan to figure out a way to harness that energy and anger. And they've got a hell of a job.
On this potential third party run, if the Senator McCain and Senator Sasse thing actually takes off, I guess they'd have to find an existing line like the Constitution Party or something like that and place a candidate on it. But what kind of coalition would vote for such a candidate? Because I guess the Republicans, since, as you say, so many Republicans in the primary electorate have fallen in behind him now, what kind of Republicans would be in that coalition? Would it be sort of John Kasich moderate Republicans and Ted Cruz evangelical Republicans? That's a very strange bedfellow mix.
Well, look, I don't think it's any. There's no orthodoxy here in terms of the way that people are going to behave. Again, I don't think it's so much. I think the threat is less the third party, though it could be, you know, in battleground states where Trump is competitive. And by the way, it's not clear Trump will be competitive in traditional battleground states, right? But you know, a third party could injure him if, say, Florida is close, potentially in the way that Nader did to Gore. I think the bigger issue here is just people sitting on their hands. I think the real third-party candidate is not voting for the Republicans.
We have 30 seconds before you have to go, I know, and then we're going to continue with some other guests. What's the Kasich factor? He didn't drop out yesterday like Cruz did.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Kasich has a campaign manager, John Weaver, who's tenacious, really understands the process. I think what Kasich wants to do at this point in time is not dissimilar from what Bernie Sanders' strategy is coalescing into, shaping the platform. That's what's going to happen in Cleveland, Brian, as opposed to sort of a contested floor battle. You're going to see a battle over the platform. There's going to be people like Kasich pushing for something that's more moderate, less extreme, to counter what's going on with Trump. Again, to save state houses and down-ballot Republicans.
Glenn Thrush, chief political correspondent for Politico, thank you very much.
Great talking to you.
We understand, and I do not deny it for one second, that we have an uphill battle in front of us. But I think we have a path toward victory, although it is a narrow path. Our goal is twofold. Number one, to win a majority of pledged delegates. Number two, it is to make sure that in those states where we have won landslide victories, you know, 65-70% of the votes, that the superdelegates in those states listen to their constituents.
Well, Trump wasn't the only winner yesterday. Bernie Sanders' victory was an upset. We'll bring on two more guests now to talk about both parties' races. New York Times political correspondent Patrick Healy, he covered the Indiana vote. And Jennifer Rubin, Washington Post columnist, writes the paper's Right Turn blog and is writing today on what the heck does the party do now if Donald Trump is the nominee. Jennifer, Patrick, welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be here.
Thanks, Brian.
Patrick, you wrote in your article today about Indiana. After closing the gap with blue-collar white voters in parts of the Northeast last week, Mrs. Clinton lost them by 30 points in Indiana. She also again suffered with self-identified independents, casting ballots in the Democratic contest 73% backed Mr. Sanders. Why was this so different than, say, Maryland or Connecticut or New York?
Yeah, I think part of it was that the Clinton campaign made a strategic decision not to really try hard in Indiana. They decided not to advertise at all, whereas Bernie Sanders was up with more than $1 million in ads, and she only campaigned really one day there during the past week. And that's because their numbers showed that the electorate was likely to be still, you know, overwhelmingly kind of white, young, liberals and independents, that sort of mix. But to the specific question about blue-collar workers also, trade was a really big issue in Indiana. It's something that Bernie Sanders talked about, you know, even more, his advisors said, than he did in Pennsylvania. Maryland was always going to be a strong state for Hillary Clinton. But the Bernie really stuck to that theme. He ran ads on it and really tried to sort of focus on economic dispossession, closings of plants in Indiana that moved to other countries, and really try to sort of hit her on that. And the issue is that when you know, a candidate like Hillary Clinton doesn't really campaign forcefully and sort of push back on it, you're just going to see, you know, a goodly number of people drift to the other guy who's making a message that they resonate with.
Was this another defeat for pollsters? They didn't see this coming, right?
I think the Clinton folks and the Sanders folks both saw him tracking better than she did. But I think sort of generally, you know, with polling, we've seen misses here. I mean, the biggest one I think was in Michigan, really, for Sanders at least. It may have been some of the same things in play. I don't know if it was calculated as sufficiently as they could have, that the Clintons really kind of stood down and sort of ceded the state to him.
Listeners, your thoughts or your questions about either party's presidential race right now, 212-433-WNYC, 433. 9692. Jennifer Rubin from The Washington Post, I see you have a piece out now called Trump Rolls to Victory, The Great Separation Begins. What's the great separation?
I think the great separation is between the Trumpkins, if you will, and the never-Trump forces. I think this cuts, as your previous guest, Glenn Thrush, was saying, cuts really across ideology. There are moderates, mainstream conservatives who are staunchly anti-Trump. There are freedom caucus members and the far right that is pro-Trump. It is all jumbled up because it's really not about ideology anymore. I think what you're seeing is a separation by class, by education, and by temperament. And it's a great challenge for the Republican Party, which in its modern form was really given birth by people like Bill Buckley, intellectuals. They pride themselves on having a coherent ideology as opposed to a collection of interest groups, as the Democrats do. That's now pretty much shattered. And what is going to arise from that is really anybody's guess. What you're seeing is people who really abhor, both in temperament and in substance, what Trump is offering, essentially saying, this isn't what I signed up for. This is not the Republican Party that I joined. And you have others, either because of a mixture of opportunism or because they like this message or because they hate other people, including those in the Republican Party, have signed up with him. I don't think these two groups can coexists any longer. I think you are going to see either a third candidate or eventually a third party, and you're going to see the old Republican Party drift into what you have in Europe, which is very extreme right-wing nationalistic parties, which do not represent sort of the mainstream part of the electorate, and in particular do not really represent more educated, more affluent voters.
Can we say at this point, though, that the Trump coalition, as it's emerging in the primary season, is only those extreme right-wing nationalists? Because we've seen him go from about 35% in the early primaries and caucuses, which a lot of people thought would be his ceiling, to now bringing in people from what are considered different wings of the Republican Party and cresting over 50% in, you know, most of the last seven races. So how would you characterize the Trump coalition now in whatever its fullness is compared to like 3 months ago?
Well, as I said, I think it cuts across ideological lines. That's why you have people who fancy themselves as purists who are backing someone who has no ideology, and why you see people who are supposedly without principle standing on principle and saying, no, I'm not going to support Trump. This really does cut across ideological lines. There's no question in my mind that of the electorate that was drawn out, there was no person who was compelling enough to put together a coalition early enough to defeat Trump. And for now, the coalition as it exists is a majority of the Republican Party. The problem with that, of course, is that as soon as you get into the general election, that percentage of the general electorate drops to about 40%. And that, of course, has been the problem from the get-go. You cannot construct a political party based on this ideology and with an aversion to so many groups of Americans.
Patrick Healy, you want to get in?
Yeah, Brian, if I can add to Jennifer's good point, the candidates, the 16 other Republicans who were running for president, you know, through last year, just tied themselves in absolute knots trying to figure out how to deal with Trump, whether to sort of ignore him, dismiss him, you know, treat him credibly. And the one who sort of took him the most seriously and tried to sort of ally himself for a while with him was Ted Cruz, who ended up probably being his strongest rival and doing the best, certainly, against Trump. And you also had outside forces in the party and the donor community who also didn't know really what to do with Trump. He's probably the most underestimated politician, you know, this country's seen in some years. And now it seems like what you're finding is a party that continues to be tied in knots about how to deal with him as a nominee, whether to abide Trump but not Trumpism, and can they do that? Can they sort of hold their noses and go along or accept him or even try to advise him and influence him? That's sort of a story that we're working on now, is really trying to sort of look at, you know, to what extent different Republicans are coming inside the tent, but what they would do inside the tent. And what we're finding is just, you know, still, it's not like you flip a switch and everyone just comes over and embraces him. There's still sort of a great deal of division and naughtiness around how to see him.
Patrick, I would hardly suggest you go talk to Kelly Ayotte, who I think came out with a position today, which I really do not understand.
Republican senator from New Hampshire. Go ahead.
Yes. Yep. She supports Trump but will not endorse him.
Right.
I think that is the perfect embodiment of someone who does not know what the heck to do.
Right, thread the needle.
Yes, exactly. And she has a real problem. First of all, she's up against a relatively popular governor, someone who's intensely likable on a personal level. Ayotte has proven to be too moderate for the right wing in her party, and of course is not going to please the people who would turn out to vote for a Bernie Sanders. So she's in a heck of a lot of trouble, and she's, as you say, twisting herself in knots, and I don't think that's going to work. I think you're going to have to make your bed and stick with that. And I think what you will see among the more savvy candidates in states that are still winnable for Senate candidates, I'm talking about Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania, Rob Portman in Ohio, and whoever wins the primary for the Senate in Florida, is that you will see people who will distance themselves. They will simply say, I do not support him. Here's why you should elect me. If they're lucky, they'll have a third candidate to point to, and if not, they'll simply say, I'm the insurance policy you will need against Hillary Clinton. Rob Portman will say, we got to stop her from raising everyone's taxes and from spending us into oblivion. That's the kind of message that they will use. I think that makes sense. It's coherent intellectually, and actually politically probably is better than trying to have it every which way.
Susan on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Susan.
Hi. My personal opinion is that this is the result of what began with Nixon and the quote-unquote Southern strategy about leaving the racism underneath the table, not talking about it, but wink, wink, nod, nod. Everybody knew that's what it was, continued with Reagan. And so now Trump just is out in the open with it. And, you know, it's not under the table anymore.
Jennifer, do you accept that?
I think that's partially accurate, but not entirely. I think the Trump phenomenon is a result of two or three things. One is that you have this extreme economic dislocation, disappointment, stagnant wages, underemployment, unemployment, people dropped out of the workplace. And that has to bubble up in some fashion if neither political party have addressed that sufficiently. So you have someone who frankly, he's a charlatan who comes along and tells them all the problems are going to be solved if they put up tariffs on goods from China or they round up illegal aliens, and people will gravitate to that, unfortunately. So that's one thing, which is the economic picture. The second is that there has been a trend on the right, which I and many others on the right have resisted strenuously, which has been this migration to a protectionist and to a nativist outlook. You see it in talk radio. You see it in many of the Tea Party candidates, and it has replaced notions of free market, of competitiveness, of globalism, with really a very closed view of America and the world. Keep the foreigners out. Keep us separate, and everything will be okay. And that has been a noxious trend on the right that, again, Trump made hay of it. And I think the third thing is that we have had this very peculiar election cycle, which has kind of flipped the usual GOP pattern on the head. In the past, what's happened is you've generally had one or two mainstream candidates and then a whole bunch of more extreme, more ideological right-wing candidates. The right-wing folks have divided up the vote. cannibalized each other's vote, and you get a Mitt Romney against a Rick Santorum. You get a moderate against a more ideological candidate, and the moderate wins. Here we had the reverse. You had someone who kind of dominated with this very extreme, very loud, literally, ideology, and you had a whole slew of mainstream Republicans who kind of cannibalized each other. Remember, you know, Jeb Bush's super PAC spent $100 million basically pummeling Rubio into submission.
Yeah.
So you had a very strange political makeup that allowed him to get a very large foothold. And as Patrick said, no one really dealt with him properly. And I think actually Cruz's undoing in the final instance was because he did fawn over Trump for so long. He was in a very poor position to say this man is a pathological liar and unfit for the presidency after, you know, bowing and scraping in his presence for months and months.
And the reason he did that was because he thought, like a lot of people thought, that Trump was going to be a flash in the pan and be
right.
gone from the race. And that type of angry voter would be inherited by Ted Cruz, but obviously that strategy didn't work. My guests are Jennifer Rubin, Washington Post columnist, writes the paper's Right Turn blog, and Patrick Healy, New York Times political correspondent, and also joining us now is Fordham University political science professor Christina Greer. Hi, Christina. Welcome
Good
back.
Good morning.
So what happened on the Democratic side here? Bernie Sanders is not going away. We have a board full of callers who we'll get to one or two of in a minute who are saying Bernie Sanders is not going away. Don't talk about Hillary Clinton as the presumptive nominee and Bernie Sanders as if he's nothing. Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders voters were supposed to fold up their tents after New York and then the five states last week. Bernie Sanders was supposed to fold up his tent and just kind of start falling in line and saying, please support my positions. Mm-hmm. This hasn't happened.
I actually think it's not what has happened. It's what is happening. I mean, this is in real time. We still have states to go. I think the Sanders supporters have a real disdain for this institutionalism that they feel is taking place in both parties, but especially in their own party, with this kind of coronation of Hillary Clinton yet again. And there's a frustration. I think that, you know, there is a lot of focus on the past and who she has been and maybe not necessarily where they'd like to see the country go, especially economically and, you know, possibly some flip-flops on her behalf. And in many ways, if we think back to 2008, it really was Hillary Clinton who galvanized her supporters and really convince them to support Barack Obama. We're not seeing that with Bernie Sanders right now. He's vowed to not do that in Philadelphia either. So many Democrats were, you know, secretly giggling about the drama that would ensue and possibly still might ensue in Cleveland. But I think we need to look a little closer. Philadelphia is going to be pretty tense because it really is Bernie Sanders' job, you know, to look at his supporters and say, we fought a good fight. You know, the mathematically, it doesn't really look great for us. We really need to focus on November. So let's pack up our tents and actually support this presumptive nominee. But mathematically, he thinks that there's a path. And it's, I think, more about not just getting his message out there and keeping it in the forefront, but there are a lot of really frustrated Democrats with Obama and what they view would be a Clinton presidency.
And we played the clip earlier of Sanders saying he's going to try to argue to the superdelegates from the states mm-hmm. that he won, especially mm-hmm. the states that he won with 60, 70, 80% of the vote in at least one case, that they should switch from Hillary Clinton to him to represent the voters of their states.
Right.
I don't know that that would do it mathematically.
Right.
Patrick, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's going to be a very difficult strategy. I mean, remember, Bernie Sanders has not even been a member of the Democratic Party, you know, officially calls himself a Democrat now, but he has not spent 25 years raising money for the party, being its best fundraiser, like, you know, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, you know, often were. So the idea that his advisors tell me that he's not cold calling superdelegates at this point, that what he's going to do is wait until June, until this ends, see what the delegate count is on her part, see what it is on his, the popular vote, and then decide if he can sort of credibly go to these superdelegates in states where he won big and say, I believe that you should support me, and here's why. So he's not even doing it yet, and if he does do it, it's still going to be a very hard lift because these people are very loyal to the Clintons. They see a lot of reason to stick with them. The other thing, if I may, is just regarding 2008. I covered Hillary Clinton back then, and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, aside from the Iraq War and aside from, I would say, issues of sort of style and temperament and communications, they actually were pretty similar on policy. And the truth is that Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have major differences, and Senator Sanders has eloquently and passionately outlined sort of what those differences are. He wants to fight for them. Just because he's losing some states and winning others doesn't change, you know, his level of commitment and his belief that people are voting for him not because they want to have a beer with him, but because they really believe in his policy vision. So he's not someone like Hillary Clinton, who after the primaries ended in 2008 had a meeting with Barack Obama, went publicly endorsed him, and then basically left the scene. You know, Bernie Sanders believes that this is, you know, bigger than just a series of primaries or phone calls to superdelegates. He wants to keep going.
Dr. Greer, what do you want to...
I agree. I mean, there's very little difference between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in 2008. I mean, many people thought that Barack Obama was a lot more radical than he was, but that's just because, you know, he's the type of person that you put all of your own racialized and political hopes and dreams
on. I would say one thing, however, and that is, remember the timing of 2008. Hillary didn't officially drop out until the beginning of June. So she won a lot of late primaries after Barack Obama had really mathematically sewn up the race as well. It's not peculiar to this cycle, and I would say in part it's a result of the system of delegates that the Democratic Party has decided upon, which is this proportional system. People don't feel a need that they have to automatically get in line. They can vote their conscience for a very long time without getting down to brass tacks here, and I think that tends to happen on the Democratic side. At this time, you know, in early May in 2008, Hillary Clinton was still going strong. She was winning primary states. Remember those late states that she did very well in? They tended to be industrial states, mostly in white working class Democrats. So I don't think you should attribute all that much attention to this. And I would say one thing in Hillary's defense. She is less dependent upon Bernie Sanders to help unify the Democrats than Barack Obama was in 2008. And the reason is she gets to run against Donald Trump. And that is the best organizing principle any Democrat is going to have. It's also going to help her get a bunch of Republicans. So I think he can play his hand all he wants, but ultimately I think there's going to be a tremendous coming together on the Democratic side and also some Republicans to get away from Donald Trump.
Yeah, in theory, I agree with that. My PhD hat co-signs that completely. There are a few things that really concern me. One, when you look at the demographics of particular Bernie voters, I really do fear that they will stay home. I know the Electoral College math is definitely in favor of the Democrats, but it is very worrisome to me. Everyone keeps saying that Donald Trump is a joke. He clearly is not a joke. And I really do worry that Democrats will view this as, oh, this is fantastic. It'll be 1972 all over again, except for all the states will be blue instead of red. I don't think that this particular candidate is as easy as he seems. He is Teflon. He has taken down 20 pretty established Republicans. We know that he will get into the gutter. We know that he will bring up 1992, 1994, 1996. He will shackle Hillary Clinton to her husband. She is yet to fully decide whether or not she wants to run on his legacy or not. He will bring out Monica and Paula and Jennifer and all of these women that, you know, were either consensual or non-consensual partners of the former president. These are sort of gender issues that are going to come out. He's going to bring up racialized issues that may or may not work in very peculiar ways. He is a very dangerous person because we also see the media never asking him a follow-up question. So you can float these ideas out there that are nonsensical, complete half-truths, if not flat-out lies, and no one calls him to the mat to actually get a real policy, to pin him down. Whether he moves to the middle or not, he is in a moment, and the country's in a moment, where they actually are, in some ways, anti-intellectual in some ways, where they don't like someone actually walking them through difficult conversations about economics or world politics. So Trump just saying, yeah, I can make it better, lots of Democrats, I'm sure, are just looking at him like he's the village idiot. But there are so many people in this country that actually find that refreshing, and they don't like Hillary Clinton. And we can't underestimate the number of Democrats also who are not happy with the Democratic presumed nominee.
Christina Greer, Fordham.
I share your pain. I would say this, however, and, you know, it's funny how the sides are completely reversed now. There's something to demographics. If you look at his number with women, you look at his number with Hispanics, you look at his number with African Americans, they are beyond atrocious. So he's going to start in a very deep hole. And the electorate, as we know, has gotten progressively more diverse with each election, requiring an even higher percentage, if you will, of white males that would have to vote Republican to just keep track with the last guy who lost. So I think, although he has all the things and more that, you know, we've talked about, and no one should underestimate him, I do think the dynamics in a general election race are going to be very different. And I also think that it's time really for the media to do their job, and I could not agree more. I think it's been sort of a shameful display of just turning over their airwaves to this guy for the sake of ratings, and
so,
that's going to have to change.
So in Trump's victory speech last night, we may have heard a hint of how he will pivot to a more inclusive message for the general election. Listen.
We're going to have unbelievably great relationships with the Hispanics. The Hispanics have been so incredible to me. They want jobs. Everybody wants jobs. The African Americans want jobs. You look at what's going on. They want jobs. And we're going to bring back our jobs, and we're going to save our jobs, and people are going to have great jobs again. And this country, which is very, very divided in so many different ways, is going to become one beautiful, loving country. And we're going to love each other. We're going to cherish each other. We're going to take care of each other. And we're going to have great economic development. And we're not going to let other countries take it away from us, because that's what's been happening for far too many years. And we're not going to do it anymore.
So, Christina Greer, he's trying to reach out in some way to Hispanics and African Americans. You know, I saw Van Jones, former Obama official, commentator on CNN, African American, say the other night, look, Trump is talking in terms of jobs, and African Americans want jobs. And if he can get more than the percentage that Mitt Romney and John McCain got running against Barack Obama, if he can get up to 20-25% of African Americans, which is still a small minority, but a larger minority than Republicans usually get, because he's not seen as the old kind of Republican, then he will win a lot of swing states. Do you see that as a completely nonsensical? And he didn't predict that, Van Jones, but he said if. And he, you know.
I don't see that happening at all. I mean, I really do think that, you know, first of all, as someone who studies African-American voters, African-American voters are some of the most strategic voters out there. And so, yes, jobs are obviously incredibly important. Jobs are always the number one issue for everyone, right? Donald Trump's racist rhetoric, though, and his attachments to the Ku Klux Klan and his, you know, sort of demagoguery for all these different racial, religious, ethnic groups across the country, that's something where, you know, African-Americans are keenly aware of. It's not a racist dog whistle. We've talked about this constantly, right? It is a bullhorn and a bark of we cannot return to that type of American politic. We have been there, literally. We know what that looks like. So whether we'll stay in protectionist phase with the Clintons, that's probably the case. We know that African-Americans on the presidential level vote roughly at about 91%. I could see Hillary Clinton getting close to Barack Obama numbers at 93% and 95% because of Trump, right? And so even Latinos, I mean, there is definitely some Latinos that are anti-immigrant. That is true. There are definitely some African-Americans. There are plenty of whites who are anti-immigrant. But Trump moving to the middle, if you look at his surrogates, these are some of the most racist politicians and leaders in our country. And so I know he's going to try and distance himself from it. But at a certain point in time, he has to move out of the vague, we're going to be great. We're going to have great jobs. We're going to have a great economy. We're going to be great leaders. Some people are going to start, hopefully the media at some point, right? But people are going to demand, what does that look like? Because when you start to look at his record, when you look at the disaster that is Atlantic City or parts of Florida where he is essentially gone in, his workers get horrible wages, they get fired willy-nilly, he's anti-union, he's anti-pretty much workers' rights, right? And, you know, when you think about women and the rights that they don't have when they work at various corporations. So when you start lifting the veil and actually scratching the surface, which hopefully the media will do, then you realize that he's actually not actually a great businessman. He actually isn't great for the working man. And I cannot see him capturing a significant portion of any of the racialized electorate. And I really think that we have to make sure we don't ignore Asian Americans as well in this conversation. Oftentimes it's about blacks and Latinos. That is a growing electorate.
And they voted 70% for Obama in the last election.
Exactly.
Jennifer, did you want to agree with or disagree with that?
You know, I had a law professor way back when I was in a different field, that used to say the telltale sign of a racist is when he puts the word the before a group, the Hispanic, the African-American.
As we just heard in that clip.
Exactly. And, you know, it's always just beneath the surface. So I think that's right. I would be stunned if Hillary Clinton got less than 90% of the African-American vote. Stunned. So, you know, listen, the makeup may be a little bit different. She may have a little more difficult time in a primary running against Bernie Sanders, but I do not see young people flooding to Donald Trump. He's kind of a joke with young people on the Republican side. So it matters who you're up against. It's not a good reference point to say, well, you know, Hillary Clinton won in Nebraska in the primary, so therefore she's going to win in the general election, or Donald Trump won in New York, therefore he's going to win in the general election. We, of course, see dramatic shifts once you get into a general election setting. So I think he is not controllable. He is impulsive. The real Donald Trump will come out. It has always come out. He cannot help but patronize and insult women in the most really vile terms. He will do it again. And Hillary Clinton is smart enough to know that she can provoke him, bait him, and make him look quite foolish and quite himself to a large section of the electorate. I would also point out that he has some problems, some real problems ahead. He's going to have to stand in a civil trial on fraud for, you know, the
Trump University
in the summer. So, you know, she's going to have some gimmies as she goes along. I think the under-over on her electoral vote is about 400.
I would still be strategic, though. In debating him, because he's a slippery one. You know, Hillary Clinton is an intellect. She's very often the smartest person in the room. It is difficult to debate someone who does not play by those rules. He will not come with facts, right? He likes to float out ideas, i.e. yesterday. Maybe Ted Cruz's dad did actually help assassinate JFK. No one followed up on it, and by the end of the evening, Ted Cruz suspended his campaign. So yeah. I think she needs to be careful with him as well.
We're way over time. Patrick, you want a last word?
Yeah, just as I agree with Christina, there's a lot of sort of sideways campaigning from Trump. He's outfoxed people over and over and over again who underestimated him. And the reality is just demographically, I would just add, white women are such a problem for Trump right now. Every Republican nominee has won a majority of white women since the 1996 presidential campaign. He's running, at least according to one poll, he's down you know, more than 10 points to Hillary Clinton among white women. And it seems like in talking to him and to his advisors, they have yet to really reckon with that number. They just sort of keep assuming that all of these people are going to see Hillary Clinton through the same lens that he does and rise up against her. But that's going to be, in terms of demographic challenges, he can talk all he wants about, you know, certain groups and certain issues, but if he keeps up this offensive language, and especially, as Christina said, goes after Secretary Clinton, you know, in very kind of like personal, tawdry terms, it just could backfire so much against him.
And with the Cruz's father thing, if anybody actually stops to notice, Trump might even turn off the Cubans, who are a Republican voting bloc, but we will see. And Christina Greer, Assistant Professor of Political Science.
Associate.
Moving up in the ranks. Soon you'll be full. Are you tenured?
I am tenured.
Well, then nobody can take it away from you. Jennifer Rubin, Washington Post columnist, writes the paper's Right Turn blog. Patrick Healy, New York Times political correspondent. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
We'll continue in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.